White Area and Resistance calling. White Area and Resistance. This is the webmaster on June 11th, 2015. There are three stories today in this show. They are news stories that have come from several different sources, radio, online, television, and they are just different. They are all have a similar theme, but different in the size of scope of the abuse of the individual. The first one is a story from Max Kaiser, and it is on the IMF, the large corporations controlling the financial interests of the world in complicity with large banks, and they're perpetrating it against, in this case, would be the countries, individual countries. The second story is a story out of Russia, and it has to do with the Russians trying to organize and have unions, the corporations that come in, international corporations from outside, which would be the U.S. in this instance, and how they are trying to break the unions, subjugate the workers, and keep them under their thumb and at their demand. And as we go down from macro to micro on these stories, we come down to the individual worker. And this story comes from Florida and the Disney Corporation control of the workers in Florida, completely under their thumb with no options to get jobs other than working for the Disney Corporation, who has total control over the Floridian IT workers of that state.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. To paraphrase John Maynard Keynes, I leave the Troika to gloat over the devastation of Europe. Okay, Stacey Herbert, what the frick are you talking about?
Well, he said that during the Treaty of Versailles when he quit. He stepped off the Treaty of Versailles negotiations because he realized that the Western powers, well, the UK, US, and France, were imposing upon Germany an intolerable suffering. And he quit, saying this is going to lead to disaster. So I look around Europe today, and Germany is in the position where they could step away from imposing disaster upon Greece, and yet they refuse to. And IMF has betrayed its mission in Greece, captive to EMU creditors. The IMF's original sin in Greece was to let Dominic Strauss-Kahn hijack the institution to save Europe's banks and the euro when the crisis erupted, dooming Greece to disaster. So, you know, Greece just last week technically defaulted on a 300 million euro payment to the IMF. It's going to be bundled into a 1.6 billion euro one end of June.
Yeah, well, Greece defaulted many weeks ago. They defaulted months ago. And Germany and the IMF and the EU, they want to take Greek assets. They want the deposits. They want all the income-producing assets. And the Greeks are saying, no, we don't want to give you these assets because, first of all, the debts were fraudulently induced. You mentioned the creation of the euro. Remember, Greece was the victim of a fraud perpetrated by Goldman Sachs and others, John Paulson, hedge fund manager. And they hoisted onto them illegally hundreds of billions of euros worth of debt. And as a result, the country has collapsed, but by design, because this is exactly where Germany wanted to be at this time. They wanted to be in a position to be negotiating with a failed state so that they can grab as many assets as they possibly can on the cheap. This is the Fourth Reich on the cheap. This is a cheap way to exercise imperial power in Europe. So in that way, it's not so bloody and gutty and messy at the moment, but I think it will get.
Well, yeah, so many say that Deutsche Bank would basically collapse if Greece, not necessarily just Greece, but if Greece collapses, then Spain and Italy, can they be far behind? But, you know, after World War I, of course, the victors were and angry that they had been bloody and violent and years of conflict. And you could forgive them for their ignorance, even though John Maynard Keynes had warned them that this would be, the inevitable outcome would be total disaster. And that it would be better, in fact, to have Germany become part of the economy, somebody to trade with, rather than somebody to gloat over with vengeance. So you wonder where the vengeance is. It's like this is a financial war. The creditors feel like violent, you know, victors. They feel like they have stomped on this debtor, and they will not let this debtor, you know, get their boot off it, the face of this debtor.
Well, there's something very strategic in allowing Greece to hobble along as it is, because it keeps the euro cheaper than it would normally be if Greece were not part of the euro, and this is fantastic for German exports. So there's something very strategic in the Germans' vilification of Greece. And now, over the weekend, I don't know if you saw this, but the co-CEOs of Deutsche Bank have resigned.
Yeah, yes.
Because they realize that Deutsche Bank is about to go belly up. It's an insolvent institution that has $90 trillion worth of uncollateralized, unsecured derivative contracts that they have off the balance sheet. But once, as we saw in 2008, the credit market seize up, suddenly those appear like ghosts out of the woodwork on the balance sheet of the global economy, and you have an enormous problem. So those guys have resigned because they know that very, very soon Deutsche Bank is about to go belly up. Greece is now going to engage in an uprising, the likes we haven't seen in Europe for quite some time, and the global economy is on the verge of seizing up once again.
Now, Greece's public debt to GDP is 180% of GDP. Now, just to put that into context, the UK, at the end of World War II, theirs was 220% of GDP. And yet, they went on a huge public spending binge, which is they created the NHS. They created the National Railways. They did a lot of investment. And what happened? The economy boomed, because that's one of the ways you could resolve that debt to GDP issue. You can increase GDP. Whereas these aggressive creditors towards Greece are demanding austerity. And in this article in the Telegraph, Ambrose Evans Pritchard said now all this austerity, this imposing the austerity, would be justifiable, sort of, if the other side of the usual IMF bargain were available, i.e. debt relief and devaluation. This is how IMF programs normally work: impose tough reforms, but also wipe the slate clean on debt and restore crippled countries to external viability. All of this went out the window in Greece. The IMF enforced brute liquidation without compensating stimulus or relief. It claimed that its policies would lead to a 2.6% contraction of GDP in 2010, followed by a brisk recovery.
Well, Evans Pritchard is somebody who believes in these institutions like the IMF as being chartered with the intention of providing some useful benefit to the global economy. He's a bit of he sees the world in rose-colored glasses in many ways. He doesn't want to admit that the IMF is a rapacious creditor, along with these big banks on Wall Street and the City of London. They targeted Greece for destruction, as they targeted Lehman Brothers, as they targeted Bear Stearns for destruction, and made people... How did Jamie Dimon become a billionaire? I mean, the J.P. Morgan is essentially a utility. It's like saying the guy who runs a local electric utility became a billionaire. There's only one way you can do that. That's by stealing energy and selling it on the black market. Jamie Dimon steals, essentially, derivatives and sells them on the black market and makes $1 billion. Part of that theft is to target a country like Greece, mark it for death, destroy it, grab those assets, like the IMF did many times in South America, Latin America. We've seen this movie before. So they've never done it in Europe before, and now they're doing it in America. Their minions are in places like Baltimore, or other areas, communities. J.P. Morgan, of course, famously in various states, have bankrupted the state and stolen the pension assets. And so this is all part and parcel of the same scheme.
Actually, leaked minutes from the IMF meetings happening before the loan originally was given to Greece show that the emerging market members and Switzerland were really against the austerity measures to be imposed by the IMF in a result of this. And Ambrose Evans Pritchard says it loaded yet more debt onto the crushed shoulders of an already bankrupt country and further complicated the picture by allowing one large French bank and one German bank, no names please, to offload much of their 25 billion euros of combined exposure onto EMU taxpayers. And yet, over and over again, other than people who watch the Kaiser Report, most people in Europe will blame the Greeks themselves. They won't blame that unnamed French bank and that unnamed German bank.
It's scapegoating.
Yeah.
And we've seen that before, famously in the 30s. But let's look at this revolving door concept. People are familiar with the revolving door concept. Like, people who work in the government will end up working for private banks, and then they'll work back in the government, or activists will work for a Greenpeace, and they'll go into the government and they'll come back. This is a revolving door of debt. So the debts are on the EU's balance sheet, then they're on the Greek balance sheet, then they're on the IMF's balance sheet, then they're on the Deutsche Bank's balance sheet. And every time the debt goes through this revolving door, all the bankers get a fee. Mm. That's how Jamie Dimon and the banking class make billions of dollars, is by charging fees on the same parcel of debt that they pass around an infinite amount of times. It's called infinite rehypothecation here in London. That's the technical term for it. And is selling the same debt innumerable times and taking a fee every single time. Now, the only way they get away with it is that they've had a 28-year bull market in bonds, which means that the yields have constantly gone down. You can repackage the same garbage over and over again and get away with it. But once that bull market is over in bonds, then it's game over.
So just like John Maynard Keynes proved prophetic with his warnings about what the Versailles Treaty would do, here in the 2010 leaked memos from the IMF, showed that here is the prophetic guy, and that is Arvind Virmani, India's member, was prophetic. He said, quote, "The scale of the fiscal reduction without any monetary policy offset is unprecedented. It is a mammoth burden that the economy could hardly bear," he said. "Even if arguably the program is successfully implemented, it could trigger a deflationary spiral of falling prices, falling employment, and falling fiscal revenues that could eventually undermine the program itself." This is exactly what happened.
That is exactly what happened, but it's not by accident, it's by design. They've been targeted for death because there's a huge amount of money to be made on making negative bets on a country like Greece, like we saw with Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and other, or even, multi-level vitamin seller Herbalife was the victim of a huge short sale campaign by a large hedge fund manager. They're not that much bigger or smaller than Greece, the entire country. That's the problem when you have hedge fund managers with infinite availability to credit. They can target anything. Could be a country, could be a company.
Well, that's okay, because let's look to a lot of people out there are not Greeks, and they think, well, what does it matter to me? Well, why the battle between Athens and Brussels matters to all of you. Of course, they're one of the things that Brussels, for on behalf of the creditors, is demanding right now is that Greece impose 23% VAT on electricity and water and 11% on staple food. So these are your those Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Those are your basic needs of living. But in this article from Alex Andrew, he says the reason this matters to all is twofold. First, it forces out into the open and brings into sharp contrast the increasing divergence between the well-being of markets and the well-being of populations. Second, it marks a clear act of economic blackmail by a global de facto establishment, let's call it the Davos set, unhappy at a democratic people opting for an alternative to neoliberalism. How these tensions resolve themselves would determine whether national elections remain meaningful in any way, whether democratic change is possible, or violent revolution is in fact the only effective option.
First they came for the Greeks, then they came for the Italians, then they came for the British, then they came for me. Okay, this is what happens when you scapegoat a population, steal all their money, and start putting them into camps, and then exterminate them.
But this is also the end stage of capitalism, as would have been predicted by Marx. He predicted this financialization and these contracts of this market fundamentalism. These contracts have become holy sort of scriptures, like elevated to these divine, unbreakable contracts with some sort of market god that you can't.
No, it's
break.
Market fundamentalism. Yeah. That's why I equate Jamie Dimon with ISIS, because they're both financial or theological terrorists. They misquote their texts upon which they draw their inspiration. They're willing to die for their cause or kill other people. We saw that in 9/11, which was both Saudis and bankers working together to fulfill theological fanaticism. So there's no difference between HSBC, Al-Qaeda, Barclays, ISIS. They're cut from the same exact cloth. Christine Lagarde is a terrorist. She's a financial terrorist. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. And until you realize that, Evan Edward Pritchard, you're going to be writing gibbling nonsensical. Nobody reads this because you're not thinking like a real strategic person.
Okay, so going forward, after Greece, in a very calm way, after Greece comes Italy, after Italy comes Spain, after Spain comes Portugal comes France, after France comes the UK, after the UK comes the US. So these are the sort of conditions they're going to impose on you, is 23% VAT, that's the beginning of what they're going to charge you for your basic needs like electricity and water, 11% on your food.
Here's the solution. Buy whatever company is in the business of making body bags, buy into that company. Gotta go.
Ciao.
A few years ago, Russia was one of the most lucrative car markets in the world. Foreign automakers made investments like this Ford plant near St. Petersburg, where thousands of people assembled the Ford Fiesta and other popular models. But the economy stumbled after Russia annexed Crimea last year. The auto market tanked, with new car sales falling by 42% in April, the lowest level in more than a decade. The production line slowed and many stopped. The slump hit hard in industrial regions such as Kaluga, southwest of Moscow, which used to be one of the most successful regions in attracting foreign investment. Dmitry Kozhnev is the founder of an auto workers' union, the Inter-Regional Workers' Association.
The situation in Kaluga is very serious. It's alarming. Take Volkswagen. Their production has dropped by almost half. It's the same with the other big car makers here, Peugeot, Citroen, and Mitsubishi.
The drop in production has meant widespread layoffs at the auto plants and at their related factories that make tires and other parts. Kozhnev says the union's been able to protect its members' jobs at Volkswagen, where it has a strong contract, but not at other plants where the union was just starting to organize. Now that times are tough, Kozhnev says the authorities are cracking down on labor unions out of the fear that they'll drive foreign business away. He cites a recent police raid on a union organizing meeting.
All of us were detained. It was a special operation by 40 cops armed with machine guns. They took us to the station, took mug shots and fingerprints, just like in the movies.
Kozhnev says his members are routinely watched by a police anti-extremist squad. The region around St. Petersburg is another big hub of automaking, and it, too, has been hit hard by the financial crisis. General Motors said recently that it will idle its St. Petersburg factory and stop production of its Opel brand in Russia altogether. The layoffs have led to more labor disputes, but union official Pyotr Prinyov says the unions aren't faring well. Workers recently had to abandon a strike they had started at the Ford plant in March. Prinyov says Ford simply brought in non-union workers to replace the strikers and cut hours to as little as 2 days a week. Ted Kanis is the CEO of Ford Sollers, Ford's Russian partnership. He says the company has had to lay off workers, but it was better to cut hours to keep the remaining jobs.
This is a difficult time for us or the competition to be increasing pay, and when we're trying to hold on to everybody's job the best we can and make it through the crisis so we can all come out better on the other side.
Pyotr Prinyov, the union official, says one problem is that foreign car makers aren't really committed to Russia. When times get tough, he says, they shutter their operations and cut workers loose. Ted Kanna says that's not true. Ford's investments in Russia are too big to abandon.
I would say by the end of this year, we'll invest about $1.5 billion over the last 4 years.
Kanna is optimistic the Russian economy can bounce back. But like many business people here, he thinks that process could take up to 2 more years. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
Again, Robert Nalny back with two. The critics say the H-1B visa program is almost an incentive for American companies to replace their employees with lower-paid foreign workers. We'll hear how some Americans who are IT workers have been laid off and then required to train their own replacements from other countries. The H-1B visa program was begun in 1990. It's designed to fill jobs requiring advanced science or computer skills when American workers can't be found. Immigrants who are qualified then receive temporary work permits. Federal guidelines are clear. The practice should not adversely affect the wages or working conditions of American employees. Well, last week, the New York Times reported on what happened to 250 IT workers at corporate offices near Disney World in Orlando. Julia Preston wrote the story. Hi, Julia. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
Tell us what these workers found when they were asked to come into the office, some of them thinking they were going to get bonuses.
Well, this happened last October, and instead of getting bonuses, they were advised that they were all going to be laid off, and they were offered what was called a stay bonus if they would agree to remain for 90 days and train their replacements. And the replacements were workers brought mostly from India by a outsourcing company based in India called HCL America. And over the 90-day period, a number of these workers were actually sat at the same at the computer station with these new workers and videotaped the work that they did, and then they went through an additional trial period, and they had to demonstrate to the satisfaction of the company that they had completely trained their replacements in order to receive the severance, the full severance package.
So that's why they were willing to do it then, because the severance depended on training their replacements?
Essentially, yes. There was a bonus, 10% bonus involved, but the end of this whole process was unemployment for these workers, and so there was a considerable incentive for them to carry on through the 90-day period. One of the striking things about this that I heard from a number of workers who actually experienced this was how humiliating it was, how really distressing it was. It was not only that they were being laid off, but they were, as one person puts it, they took me out and they put somebody else in, and I had to train that person to do my job. It was the humiliation of this that really had a tremendous impact on these Americans.
Does the fact that they had to train their replacements suggest that the replacements weren't really qualified when they first came in to replace them?
I'm not sure that it necessarily suggests that, but that was the experience of many of these workers, that their replacements really did not have the same level of skills that they had developed, and so the training process was arduous in that sense. I do want to say about this that the other in this story has been these Indian workers who were brought into this situation. It's not really their fault. This is a systemic problem with the application of this visa, which has been to a certain extent hijacked by some large outsourcing companies, many of them based in India, that have made this a kind of a business model to bring these immigrants in. So it's the one thing I'm concerned about, the story that I wrote initially, that somehow the bad guys in this situation would be these Indian immigrants, and it's not really their fault.
Can the workers for Disney in this case, and I know it happens other places as well, but can these workers speak out, identify themselves, and describe what's happening, or do they have to disguise their identities?
You're talking about the Americans? Well,
yes.
The situation for the Americans, one of the reasons that I found the Disney story compelling is that in Orlando, Disney is the single largest a single site employer in the country. In other words, Disney employs 74,000 people in Orlando, and that makes it the largest employer in a single site in the United States. And so to be on the outside of that huge market domination made it very difficult for these American tech workers to look for other jobs. And so that's why I thought that this was a particularly compelling story. In addition, Disney implemented a policy in February where they instructed contractors in Orlando not to hire the people who'd been laid off for a year. Now, this has been brought to the attention of the company, and I think they're walking that back. But so many of these workers faced a kind of a double whammy for many months after they became unemployed.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break, and then we want to come back and hear more about Disney particularly and the kind of response that you got to this story about people being required to train their own replacements. Again, we're talking with Julia Preston of the New York Times. We'll be right back with To the Point for BRI. Nalini, back with To The Point, Julia Preston of the New York Times, about H-1B visas and what happened in Orlando, Florida, with the Disney Corporation, which laid off 250 people and then required them to train their own employees, something they found to be humiliating. And in order to, they had to do that in order to get their severance pay. So, Julia, what kind of reaction did you get from this story, which came out last week?
Just tremendous, huge, a deluge of comments from readers. We had almost 3,000 comments on the original story, and then we put together a roundup of the comments for a feature we have on the Times called Times Insider, and we got almost 400 comments on that. So it just unleashed this enormous feeling among our readers that this was particularly shocking conduct by Disney. I think it was, to be honest with you, I didn't anticipate how intense the reaction would be, but I think it was the fact that people think of Disney as an American company, you know, a fan, it's part of our fantasies and part of our childhood entertainment, and people were just felt like this was not appropriate for this company in particular. And in a larger sense, I think it went to not only something that's been happening broadly among tech workers, American tech workers, but also a kind of feeling of insecurity and uncertainty that many Americans have about big corporations and whether or not those corporations still have their interests at heart. So it turned out to be a story that resonated very broadly, I think, among our readers.
This has already gotten the attention of Congress.
Yes. Senator Nelson from Florida asked for the Department of Homeland Security to examine the visa program. And there has already been a debate going on in Congress about this program. And I think there have been efforts over the years to by tech companies and by other companies to expand the number of these visas, and I think there is clearly a legitimate use for this visa, and if properly used, this visa could be used to bring people that have special skills and can fill holes and complement the Americans in a workforce, and it is a visa that can contribute to the economy, but this is clearly not what this visa was supposed to do. This is a kind of an extreme case where perhaps not the letter of the law was abused, but this is clearly not what the spirit and the intent of this visa is supposed to be.
Some people in Congress are being pressured to increase the number of visas available. Who's on which side?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, or rather, it's not a partisan issue. For example, the bill that has been offered in the Senate to increase the number of visas has support from both Republicans and Democrats. And on the side of lawmakers who are seeking to increase the protections for Americans before there's any increase in numbers, you also have Senator Grassley, who's a Republican, and Senator Durbin, who's a Democrat, who've been kind of the champions of that side of the argument. So this is not a partisan issue, but you do have sustained pressure from some of the big tech companies, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, to increase the number of visas. And so that's been a driving force behind the debate.
Orrin Hatch, the Republican from Utah, and Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat from Connecticut, are backing an increase in the number of visas.
Yes, that's right. And again, you know, I think there is a legitimate use for these visas, but this is clearly, I think, not it.
Google, Facebook, Microsoft, all asking for increased visas?
Because the intent of the visa is to provide an opportunity for people that have, you know, advanced skills, specific skills, to come and fill holes in the labor force. or to bring some very special kind of skill to serve the American economy. But the part of the problem has been that there are significant loopholes in the legislation as it exists now and in the regulations, so that these large Indian-based outsourcing companies don't really have to show that they either attempted to recruit an American or that they were not displacing an American.
All right.
That's the intent of the law, but in practice, there's no requirement there that they have to do that.
Julia Preston, National Immigration Reporter for The New York Times. Many thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
During an online town hall conducted for his reelection campaign in 2012, a woman asked President Obama why the H-1B program continues. Her husband, a semiconductor engineer with 10 years of experience, couldn't find a job. The president was surprised, and he said the tech industry was telling him there weren't enough skilled engineers.
If you send me your husband's resume, I'd be interested in finding out exactly what's happening right there, because the word we're getting is that somebody in that kind of high-tech field, that kind of engineer, should be able to find something right away. And the H-1B should be reserved only for those companies who say they cannot find somebody in that particular field.
Should be reserved for somebody in that particular field who is an American, unless the company can't find an American to do the job. Well, we heard what happened at Disney. Our next guest was a longtime IT employee for Southern California Edison. That's an enormous utility, provides electricity to 14 million people. He was replaced in January by a foreign worker on an H-1B visa. Can't use his name because his severance package requires him not to make disparaging comments about his former employer. We'll call him John. Good to have you on our program. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Was your experience similar to what we heard about Disney?
It was as if she was right next to me. We had to do the same thing. We many of us, and there's over 500 that got laid off or outsourced. Part of the severance package requirement was to train your replacement. And speaking from my experience, you know, listening to Julia, it's difficult to distill over many years of my institutional knowledge and application support to give my skills to somebody in 3 months of training. And it just doesn't make sense. If the visas required someone to have special skills, we wouldn't need to train them.
How long did you work for Southern California Edison?
Over 15 years.
And what'd you do?
I was I'd say it was an application programmer, supported our help desk.
So obviously the technology's changed a lot over 15 years. Were you able to keep up? Did anybody ever say that you weren't doing the job right?
No, I was able to keep up. You know, we had to go through vendor training. You just have to keep up with your skills, otherwise you're not doing the job. But no, there was never any management that said, you're not working out, we need to get rid of you. Nothing like that.
Now, this was called a reorganization, as I understand it, by Southern California Edison. How'd you find out what was happening?
We received emails, and it was called the IT transformation. And we received that probably a year ago or so, April. In 2014, we received a notification that this transformation was coming.
And you really felt that the person that you had to train to do your job, when they arrived, weren't up to speed, that they weren't, you might have been able to train them, but they weren't a satisfactory replacement.
Exactly. They didn't have any background in the application that I supported, and it was difficult to tell them, this is how this application will break, and this is what you do to fix it. You know, it's not like it's a broken widget and you go here and fix it. It's more than that, and 3 months is not enough.
How long ago did this happen, and have you been able to find another job?
No, to speak to your second point, no, I've been actively seeking employment since January 9th. It's just it's kind of frustrating to be looking out. And, I mean, where I live, I can do a search for jobs in a 50-mile radius, and there's hundreds of IT jobs. So it just makes no sense. But, it's very frustrating.
You worked there for 15 years. How old are you?
I'll say I'm past 60.
Do you think that's working against you?
I would definitely believe that that would be. It's hard to pinpoint, but yeah, I'm sure it is.
We heard this extraordinary story from Julia Preston of the New York Times that one of the things Disney did, dominating the work market in Orlando as it does, was to tell other IT employers not to hire its former employer employees for a year or so. Have you ever found out anything like that happening from Southern California Edison?
I haven't heard that. I wouldn't think that they would do such a thing.
Were the people that replaced you and 500 other people at Edison paid less?
I can't speak to that exactly, but I'm sure they were. I can't say. I don't know what their rate of pay was.
And again, you had to train them, train your replacements, in order to get severance.
Yes, that was part of the severance agreement. And like Julia said, it was, I'll use her word, it was humiliating. I mean, you're sitting next to somebody and you're looking at them and it's like, you're my replacement, I have to train you. So it's a very difficult situation.
What did the people at Edison tell you?
About what?
How did they explain this? How did people you knew in management deal with you under these circumstances?
It was just part of this is where we're going. This is the way IT is going to be, and this is where we're headed. And basically, you had to be on board if you wanted, otherwise no severance. And to some people, if you had 15, 20, 25 years with a company, your severance would amount to a year's salary. So that was a significant amount of money to not give up. So we were kind of, our hands were tied.
All right. John, again, formerly an IT employee for Southern California Edison, this giant utility in this part of the country, who was replaced and had to train his own replacement. Ron Hira is a professor of public policy at Howard University. He's also a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute, which gets some of its funding from organized labor. His most recent book is Outsourcing America. That's at Economic he's at Economic Policy. Ron Hira, thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you for having me on.
You've done a lot of research about this, obviously, to write to Outsourcing America. What can you tell us about how widespread this practice is and whether, as federal guidelines require, companies are careful to make sure that this does not adversely affect the wages or working conditions of American employees?
This is very widespread. It's been going on for a long time. And we're talking about tens of thousands of Americans who are being forced to do this over the years. We don't have exact figures, but certainly we know that the outsourcing firms that have this business model of bringing in cheaper workers are getting at least half of the annual quota of H-1B, so about 40,000 each year are being used purely for cheap labor, and so it is quite widespread. Now, the law does say that it shouldn't adversely impact U.S. workers. Obviously, what you've just heard from your worker, John, and also from Julia Preston, and I've talked to workers not just at Southern California Edison or Disney, but also at Pfizer, Northeast Utilities, Xerox, Harley-Davidson, Fossil. I could go on all of the major companies, and they've described very similar circumstances where they've been training their foreign replacements who are cheaper. They're obviously being adversely impacted, but the president, the administration, Congress is really doing nothing about it.
Let me quickly go back to John. One of the things Julia Preston was careful to say was she didn't think the people that are doing the replacing are necessarily bad guys. It's really this industry that has sprung up of outsourcing companies. Do you agree with that? Did you feel that way, or were you angry at the person who was going to replace you?
Oh, no, I wasn't angry. I know it's not him. A lot of the people that I dealt with two or three nice people. I mean, you know, you're sitting next to them and they're smiling and, you know, we both know what's going on. It's just an uncomfortable situation, but there's no animosity towards these people.
So, Ron Hira, tell us more about these outsourcing companies.
Sure. So this is a business model that's grown up over the last 15 years. And this is the who's who of major IT outsourcing firms. Many of them are based in India, but many of them are also here in the U.S. So Tata Consultancy, Infosys, Wipro, HCL are major Indian-based IT companies. But you've got similar business models. Cognizant, which is a spinoff of Dun & Bradstreet based in Teaneck, New Jersey, does the same thing, as well as IBM and Accenture. they exploit these loopholes too to replace and substitute for American workers. I'd also add that, many of, some of my cousins are actually benefiting from this. My family's originally from India, and some of my family's still in India, and some have benefited by coming over.
Have any of them been involved with outsourcing companies?
Yes, that's right, and they've been over here working for some of the major firms.
Okay, so they're part of this process. Everybody's caught up in it, it sounds like. You say 40,000 people a year.
It's a very lucrative business model. Just to give you a sense, Infosys is a publicly traded company with a market capitalization, a market value of $40 billion. This is huge business.
Okay. Ron Hira, professor of public policy at Howard University. We're going to come back. Warren, only back with To the Point. We're talking today about H-1B visas, which are supposed to be for when there is a shortage of highly skilled American workers to be temporarily replaced by people from overseas. What we're hearing is that there is now an industry that supplies something like 40,000 people a year from other countries who are paid less and who are trained by the American workers whom they are replacing. Gary Beach is a guest columnist at the Wall Street Journal. He's also a former publisher of CIO Magazine, which is for tech executives. He's author of The U.S. Technology Skills Gap, about the history of American STEM education. That stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Gary Beach, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What do you have to say about this practice that we have heard about now extensively on our program?
Well, I agree with what Julia was saying about the humiliation aspect of how the outsourcing efforts at Disney and Southern California Edison, and as Ron was saying, over the 15 years, tens of thousands of others, it really is, to some extent, I would use the word despicable in terms of a management approach. They take the U.S. workers and they've got them their hand tied, so to speak, in terms of they want to get their severance, as John was talking about. They've got to work with the workers. But I think you have to also look at it in the context of there's about 7 million IT workers here in America, and 65,000 and 85,000, if you can count the folks on the visa program or in higher ed or graduate school. It's not a big percentage, I just think we need to keep that in mind as we look at it. But the program was intended, when it was put in place in 1990, to complement, not replace, American workers, and it's gotten a bit out of hand.
When you say that you talk about education, are you suggesting that there aren't enough people coming along in order to replace IT workers as they leave the workforce, whether they are retiring or voluntarily leaving?
Well, absolutely, on two ends of the spectrum. John was talking about his job and his age. There's this talk is a concept called the silver tsunami going on all across America, not just in the IT industry. In the IT industry, the median age of a worker is 53 years old. So that means half of all those 7 million IT workers in our country are over 53. And they probably have, although John had kept up with his skill set, and kudos to him, the many have not, in my opinion, in terms of writing about this subject for a number of years. And on the other end of the pipeline, Warren, you have younger Americans. If you benchmark it against studies that are done by the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, American 15-year-olds are 27th in the world in science, 36th in the world in math, and it gets worse for 16 to 55-year-olds in terms of our country. Those workers rank 20th out of 22nd. So the cavalry ain't coming up behind. So one of the words that we've not had in this conversation is the whole concept of the world is flat and globalization. I think that I was a publisher for 27 years. Was it my job? Yeah, it was my job, but I didn't own it. And I think sometimes workers think that their job is their job. And the whole globalization aspect, you know, the 20th century was the American century. The 21st century is going to be the globalization century to some extent. And I think we all have to keep that in perspective, that while I might have competed with someone in the cubicle next to me or on the floor above me when I went through my career, what's going to happen in the out years is American workers are going to be competing for jobs against workers anywhere around the world that have a high-speed internet connection that's secure.
Gary Beach, a guest columnist at the Wall Street Journal, author of the U.S. Technology Skills Gap. I want to go back to Ron Hira, our professor of public policy at Howard University, who's written Outsourcing America. What do you say to what we've just heard from Gary Beach, that in fact this may be part of the way that the world economy is evolving, that you don't own your own job?
Well, I disagree with the way that he's framing it in terms of the H-1B visa, right? So certainly globalization's happening, and a lot of jobs have been offshored, mostly to India, in the IT sector. But what you're now telling people is that we're going to import these, my cousins literally, from India, and you're going to train them. That's government active policy of destroying American jobs. I mean, that's facilitating the offshoring, plus you're destroying those American jobs. I don't see how anybody can defend that. And whether you want to use language about globalization and everything else, it doesn't make any sense. And it certainly isn't the intent, and no politician has claimed that the intent of the H-1B program is to import people to destroy American jobs. I'd also disagree with the way he's doing his analysis in terms of the numbers. There's about 4 million computer occupations, and the number of H-1Bs, because H-1Bs can be here up to 6 years, there's probably about 650,000 H-1Bs. No one knows for sure. There's a number of about 350,000 L-1s. You're talking about a pretty significant share of the IT occupations are guest workers, many of them being paid way below market wages. And that has an effect directly in terms of employment, but also secondarily in terms of wage pressure on IT workers.
So, Gary Beach, in addition to saying that this was to some extent the wave of the future, you also said it was despicable from the standpoint of the employers themselves. Is this a government policy to destroy jobs? You've advocated, as I understand it, lifting the caps on H-1B visas altogether.
Yeah, my point there was 65 or 85,000. That number is not working, obviously, if 1 week later there are, I believe, 233,000 applications were submitted. That was the point I was trying to make there, to make it a market-based decision rather than a political one.
Well, is it really market-based if the law is being used in the way that that we have heard?
Well, yeah, I believe it is in terms of there's a difference between 233,000 and 65,000 that needs to – you be evened out someplace in the middle or above it, below it. I do, you know, I agree with Ron in terms of I read his testimony to Congress in March, and the policies that he proposes are you know, he poses no limitations on employers' ability to hire foreign workers who truly complement the American workforce and talent pool, and I think that's what we're talking about here. That at least that's the position I would take, that this is supposedly a complementary program, not a replacement program. And the word despicable and that we used or humiliating earlier was I was addressing the management practices of Southern California Edison and Disney in terms of how they rolled these programs out.
Ron Hira, are these executives of these companies making decisions that, from a capitalist standpoint, are perfectly rational? They want to cut costs. They want to increase profits. Here's a way to do it.
Yeah, so I think that's right. I mean, I think we're in what's changed is basically corporate norms have changed and corporate values have changed from a stakeholder value model where the stakeholders included workers, the community, and the nation to a purely shareholder value proposition and goal, where they only care about increasing profits. And of course, the executives are compensated not by how many American workers they have or even how they treat their workers, but by the share price going up. Much of the compensation, the $46 million that Bob Iger got, CEO of Disney, is from stock. The stock price has tripled by 150% over the last 3 years. Disney's not starving. It had record profits of $7.5 billion. So at some point you have to get, you know, ask the question, when are these CEOs and the shareholders going to be satiated? When are they going to share some of those profits and prosperity with the workers who have created that value? I think the answer is never. And so you have to have policies in place that give workers at least a fair shake. And when you're bringing in guest workers, you're really creating unfair intervention into the labor market, unfair competition for those workers.
Let me go back to John. That is an alias that we are using because he's not in a position to identify himself when he talks about his former employer, Southern California Edison, where he worked for 15 years as an IT employee and then was replaced and had to train his own replacement who came from another country. And John, what sort of atmosphere does this create in the workplace?
Well, the morale is at rock bottom. When you know months out that your job is gone, it's not conducive to work. The morale just was at the bottom. And if I may just speak to what the last caller or the gentleman you had, in this case, I think it was market driven. I think it was stock price. You know, cutting costs, and the best way to do it, the easiest way for them to do it, was to outsource the IT.
So, Gary Beach, back to you. At some point, isn't it important for companies to improve morale rather than tearing it apart?
Oh, absolutely, because one of the biggest issues in the technology business is attracting and retaining talent. And, you know, IT workers, you know, have choices. You know, John's looking for a job. Other workers who are employed that could be poached away. It's very, very important, particularly when you consider that yesterday the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with its JOLTS report, job opening labor turnover, and reported that 5.4 million jobs are open right now. And The kind of work, though, is changing within IT. As John might attest to, he worked on the help desk and did application programming at Southern California Edison. You know, companies are now also looking to develop social business apps, mobile, security, big data analytics, and so the composition of the IT workforce is dramatically changing. And I think Ron made a good point about CEO pay and talking about Robert Iger and what have you. I think, I don't want to put words in Ron's mouth, but I, from some of the stuff I was reading, you know, the difference between what an average salary, whether it's at Computer World or other places that Ron quotes, the difference between an H-1B visa worker and this average is somewhere about $20,000 to $25,000 less expensive. And if you look at Southern California Edison as an example, let's say 450 people times 20,000, you know, that's, you know, probably about $8 million. Whether that's going to make an impact on the CEO of a $13 billion company's payroll pay package, I don't know. But yeah, the point I was trying to make is the type of work that's being done, that needs to be done, is different than it was 15 years ago.
Again, Gary Beach is a guest columnist at the Wall Street Journal and author of The U.S. Technology Skills Gap. Ron Hira is a professor of public policy at Howard University. Ron Hira, what do you think should be done?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. I mean, we want to mend the program, the H-1B program, not end it. And the simplest way to do that is to raise the wage floors significantly so that this is not being used for cheap labor. Congress sets the wage floors, and they've set it so low that it's way below market wages, below what an American would be paid. And
you mean
so
it set the wage floor for H-1B visas?
That's correct.
Not
yeah.
for everybody, yeah.
That's correct. So we want to raise those wage floors so that because the H-1B worker doesn't hold the work permit, the employer does. The employer sponsors. And by the way, this is a guest worker program. Most of these large companies aren't sponsoring these people for permanent immigration, for green cards. So what you want to do is basically raise those wage floors very significantly so that it's used sparingly for specialized skills, for people that really do have specialized talent, rather than as a way to replace Americans. That's the most straightforward way of doing it. Unfortunately, the tech industry has fought that tooth and nail.
If these are guest workers who aren't even getting green cards, is somebody going to have to replace them?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a whole business model around shuttling people in. Of course, they can stay up to 6 years, and so it takes a little time, but they'll bring in somebody else on a visa to learn the job. The other point I would make is that this is having a really deleterious effect in terms of training. Firms have really disinvested in training their incumbent workers and new workers in terms of on-the-job training. And to go to Gary's point, I mean, John, our worker here, his job didn't disappear. It's not going to, offshore. It's staying here. It's geographically sticky. He's just being replaced.
Okay. That's all the time we have for this. Ron Hero, once again, at Howard University. Gary Beach.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then join in the grand industrial band. Would you from misery and hunger be free? Then come do your share like a man. There is power in the band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in the shack away in the back? Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back? There is power in the band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. If you've had enough of the blood of the lamb, then join in the grand industrial band. If for a change you would have eggs and ham, then come do your share like a man. There is power in the band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.